Tonight's lecture, I'd just like to remind you that the next lecture given by Dr. Lyman will take place 2 weeks from tonight. That's Wednesday, March 2nd at 8:15, and the topic will be Scholars and Scoundrels, Modern Jewish Forgery of the Talmud. So next week is Purim, giving you an off week, and is Panis Esther, and the following week will be the continuation of the lecture series. One more announcement before we begin tonight's lecture, and that is, I'd like to mention that this evening's lecture is being sponsored by an anonymous donor, the Ilui Nishmas Moshe Aryeh Ben Hechover Shmuel. Thank you very much. Regarding tonight's lecture on Red Sea Scrolls, according to Herschel Shanks, founder and editor of Biblical Archaeology Review, the Dead Sea Scrolls are the greatest manuscript discovery of the 20th century. They have ignited the imagination of non-scholar and scholar alike. A library of over 800 texts, they cast a direct light on the critical period more than 2,000 years ago, out of which Christianity and Rabbinic Judaism emerged. In recent years, controversy has enveloped the Dead Sea Scrolls as various factions have struggled to either suppress or speed up publication of these invaluable manuscripts. Many of us here this evening have seen these manuscripts in Yerushalayim at the Shrine of the Book or at the New York Public Library, which recently exhibited portions of the scrolls. I'm not privy to what aspect of the scrolls Dr. Lyman will deal with tonight, but I am sure that for all of us, it will certainly be an enlightening experience. And now I present to you Dr. Shmuel Lyman.
Bishul Sarab Moradi Asra, Robert Holkowitz. Friends. One day, in the early spring of 1947, a Bedouin of the Tamir tribe in Jordan was searching for a stray goat near the Dead Sea. Thinking that it may have wandered into a nearby cave, he threw a stone into the cave, and instead of a goat running out, he heard the shattering sound of broken glass. By chance, he had hit an ancient jar and shattered it. That jar contained an ancient scroll, the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls to be discovered in the 20th century. And it is a sobering thought for modern scholars, and they ought to keep it in mind at all times, that the Dead Sea Scrolls, and as Yossi just indicated, what is generally hailed as the most significant archaeological discovery of modern times, were first discovered by a goat. Now, these scrolls were discovered in caves on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. To pass this around, that is just a beautiful photograph of what these caves look like. They are high up on the side of cliffs, not easily scalable, and indeed very often those who are searching these caves need to hang by ropes, as indeed in this photograph, simply to enter the caves and come out with the scrolls and then get back to the surface. So we'll pass this around. Some of the caves where Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. That magazine that's circulating, and the editor's name was mentioned by Yossi Zonnenblick, is called Biblical Archaeology Review. And I recommend it to you if you're really interested in biblical archaeology. This magazine is published about 10 times a year. It is a superb magazine with beautiful photographs and well worth the investment if you want to keep up to date on the latest archaeological discoveries. I don't get a percentage on this. I'm just mentioning it there. It's a way that you could learn more about biblical archaeology. In all, 11 caves were discovered on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, and they contain approximately 800 manuscripts to date. and literally thousands and tens of thousands of fragments of manuscripts. All these manuscripts are approximately 2,000 years old and more. And it would take the rest of the hour allotted to me tonight just to describe to you a general catalog of the kinds of scrolls that were recovered. I won't do that, though I do want to point out at least some of the highlights among those discoveries, and then immediately turn to aspects of those discoveries as they shed light on biblical and rabbinic literature. And already at the, those of you who have made it through the storm at the previous lecture, there I already stressed a very important aspect of the Dead Sea Scrolls as it relates to the authenticity of the biblical texts. We now have copies of Tanakh that are 2,000 years old in the original Hebrew, and the key point here is that our tradition, our Masorah, is vindicated. There is no question that our parents and grandparents and our forefathers have very carefully preserved the text of Tanakh for thousands and thousands of years to this day, and while our detractors once claimed otherwise, they no longer can do so because we now have the evidence in hand in these scrolls, namely in those of the 800 scrolls that are copies of Tanakh. Copies of every book of Tanakh were discovered except Megillas Esther. So it's timely that this presentation is being made now. And there's every reason to believe, without going into detail here, that this Jewish sect did not commemorate Purim. Those of you who know your Babli and your Rishalmi well will know that in the Gemara itself there was much discussion as to whether Megillas Esther should be included in Tanakh. Esther said, Kisvuni Ladoros, and there was much debate about it, and it almost didn't make it into Tanakh. And in fact, there are opinions expressed in Shas, opinions, even of Amoraim, Amoraic opinions, that Esther is not written Beruach HaKodesh, it's not B'tamei Esther Yadayim. So this was a matter that was debated even in rabbinic circles, how much more so in other groups of Jews who didn't have rabbinic traditions, and for whatever reasons, and one can think of some, did not include this book in Tanakh. Remember, Megillas Esther is one of two books in Tanakh that does not have a divine name in it. Shem Hashem, clearly, Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, or Elohim, these names do not occur anywhere in Megillas Esther, and one could imagine a group of Jews saying, we won't include this book in our Tanakh. Aside from copies of all the books of Tanakh, copies of other books that circulated in Second Temple times, books that we today call the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha, copies of those books were discovered. So perhaps the most famous that I'll mention immediately is anyone who learns Gemara, and Rashi for that matter, on Chumash, will know that the Gemara and Rashi and so on, rabbinic literature, regularly cites verses from a book called Ben Sira, Sefer Ben Sira. One shouldn't expound on matters that move beyond one's competence. This is a famous verse in the book of Ben Sira that's cited in the Gemara. Well, the book of Ben Sira was lost. It's not been available since at least medieval times. The last Jew who had a copy of Ben Sira was Rav Tzadi Gaon, and no copies were available until the 20th century through various discoveries. A few pages and parts of the Ben Sira scroll were discovered in what's known as the Cairo Geniza at the turn of this century. But now we actually have full copies of Ben Sira. And I'm holding the Ben Sira scroll from Masada. This is not from one of those 11 caves, but it is from the Judean desert. Those of you who've been to Qumran, where the caves are, will know that if you travel further southward, you'll come to Ein Gedi, and if you travel further southward, you'll come to Masada. And scrolls were found in all those places and throughout the Judean desert. When we speak about the Dead Sea Scrolls, there are two definitions. There is a narrow definition, which means just the scrolls discovered in the 11 caves, and there's a broader definition, all the scrolls that have been discovered since then in the Judean desert. That would include copies of Ben Sira. I'll pass this around, and you're more than welcome to take a look at it. I have to tell you, those of you who learned Chumash with Rashi, we'll remember in the Sefer Dvarim, actually in the Parsha of Kriya Shema, Rashi cites a pasuk that we don't have anywhere in Tanakh. Rashi cites a beautiful pasuk, and he says, Kidichsiv the Megillah, as is written in the Megillah. And Rashi says, Im Tazrei Yom, Yomayim Ezeko, is Hashem is speaking, if you abandon me or if you abandon my Torah for a day, Yomayim Ezveka, I abandon you for 2 days. It's a beautiful, beautiful pasuk, and nowhere in time. And I don't want to mislead you, it hasn't been discovered yet in the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been published to date. But I don't doubt, I am virtually certain that as all the hundreds and thousands of fragments will be published, they will find that Megillah, they're very likely to find it, from which Rashi cited that pasuk. Now Rashi didn't invent the pasuk himself, that Rashi is simply presenting in Chumash a Gemara, Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi at the end of Maseches Brachos. But Yerushalmi says, because it's in the Megillah, as is written in the Megillah, Im Tazveini Yom, Yomayim Ezveka, it's a very beautiful pasuk. It's not in Tanakh, but it's in one of those forums like Ben Sira. Many of these forums now are being recovered from among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Aside from Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha, Aramaic translations of biblical books, what we call Targumim, have been discovered, and specifically a Targum on Sefer Iyov, which is very interesting. Midrashim, that we otherwise didn't know about, have been discovered. A beautiful Midrash on Sefer Chumash Bereishis. It's called the Genesis Apocryphon in the English and Hebrew version. I just want to show you a photograph of what a Dead Sea Scroll looks like. It's in the Genesis Apocryphon when it's discovered. It required the work of many chemists and others in order to learn how to unroll these scrolls that haven't been unrolled in 2,000 years. You can imagine it's no easy task. But that's the science today. They know how to do it. They then unroll the scroll. And when the scroll is unrolled, it eventually gets published in a modern publication where one page has a photograph of the scroll, the other page has the typeset in modern Hebrew letters. Usually there's an English version, there'll be an English translation. In this particular medrash, for example, there's a vivid description of Sarah, what Sarah looked like, what color hair she had, and much more information about her lineage from both sides of the family, names of parents, grandparents, and so on, things that we don't always know from rabbinic literature. Aside from these biblical-like materials, commentaries on biblical books, Dead Sea Scrolls also include much sectarian literature. The Dead Sea Scrolls belong to a group of Jews, very religious Jews. New York Times would call them fundamentalists. They read this literature. Fundamentalist type Jews, very strict in their observances, but not Jews who were our ancestors. These are not Torah true Jews in the sense that we understand it. These are not Tanon, these are not Amoron. These were Jews who lived in the first centuries BC and the first centuries CE, very religious sect, with their own halachic works, their own law codes. So aside from these biblical books, we actually have halachic texts. A famous scroll called Serech HaYachad, which is a kind of constitution of the sect. If you want to join this group, here are the rules and regulations of the group that you have to follow if you're going to join this group. These are very interesting, obviously, for the history of halacha and so on. I'll mention now two very important scrolls, and with that, I'll move on to a discussion of the general controversy that's going on now, and then some samples of how important, just how important the scrolls are for our own understanding of ourselves and of our text. The two most important scrolls to be published, one has been published fairly recently, in the last decade or so. One has not yet been published, but will appear very shortly, and I want you to be aware of these because these are astounding. Now, the first of these two scrolls is called Megillat HaMikdash. Megillat HaMikdash, or the Temple Scroll. It is the largest of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It is a huge scroll, the equivalent of a Sefer Torah. This is what it looked like when it was unrolled. It looks pretty familiar to most of you, not very different from a Sefer Torah. You can see it's huge. You want to pass that around? It's called by scholars Megillat HaMikdash because it lists all the rules and regulations for the Beis HaMikdash. And it also contains the 613 commandments, the Taryag Mitzvot. It reads like a Sefer Torah. And it incorporates most of the Sefer Torah that we have today. but it is entirely written in the first person. It is Hashem is speaking, and every verse, whereas in the Torah it says, Vayadaber Hashem al Moshe Lemar, in the third person, and Moshe writes down, by and large, what Hashem says. In this Sefer Torah, Hashem is the speaker, and Hashem says, and I say unto you as follows, and follow all the mitzvahs and so on. So this is an incredible book. No one's ever seen such a thing before. If you like, it's a rewriting of a Sefer Torah. It's not anything that's been... No, very often it does, but not always. Very often it does, and in some places it has the unique interpretations and commandments of this group as distinct from our Sefer Torah, so you can imagine why this is of some significance. The second scroll, which is really exciting for the study of rabbinic literature, even aside from this one, is called Miktzat Maasei Torah, and when it's published, it'll be in the New York Times, and you'll all read about it. This is another halachic text. You see, halachic texts are always interesting, because remember, we have Mishnayos, we have Talmud, Bavli, Yerushalmi. We have no literature between Tanakh, and Tanakh ends around 500 or 400 BCE, the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who closed Tanakh after Sefer Divrei HaYamim and after Chagai Zecharia Malachi. We have no literature, no Jewish literature, really, until we get to Mishnah. There's one little book called Megillas Tanis. With that exception, we come to Mishnah, which was edited around the year 200 of the Common Era. In other words, some 600 years, we have absolutely no literature preserved. Yet, that's exactly from that 600-year period that all this literature comes from. So this fills a tremendous gap and enables us to see what life looked like at that time. So the second scroll, another halakhic scroll, this will tell us what halakha looked like, is called Miktzat Maasei Torah. Maasei means mitzvot. Maasei in Hebrew then, and in Hebrew in the medieval period, meant deeds, that is, the mitzvot that you have to do. Miktzat Maasei Torah, a list of various mitzvot of the Torah. And this scroll is particularly important for us because it is written by the founder of the sect. We don't know his name, but it's clearly written by a leader, not the founder, the leader of this Dead Sea group. And it's written to the Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim. It's addressed to the Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim, who's one of us. And this is a letter from the head of the group in Qumran to the Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim, and apparently this is the copy they kept home. And the letter says, you Jews in Yerushalayim, you've strayed from the path. You no longer follow the Torah the way you should. And I'm going to list in my letter to you all the places where we hold one way and you hold another way. And then follows a complete list of debates between the sect, what the sect does, how the sect is Shomer Shabbos, and how the Jews in Yerushalayim are Shomer Shabbos. And everything that it says in this scroll, or virtually everything in this scroll, where it says, and you do such and such, is in the Gemara. And it's very clearly in the Gemara. And many of the things that the sect does, where it says, the head of the sect says, and we do such and such, the Gemara says about that same thing, that's what the Tzedukim do. So here we have a copy of a text written not by us, but by a group of Tzedukim themselves, if you like, their perspective, arguing us, claiming that we strayed, they're the ones who are doing it correctly with proofs, and so on and so forth. So this is a fascinating text, will shed much light on halacha, relates directly to passages in Mishnah and Talmud, and when it appears in print, which will be very shortly, there's no question, there'll be much debate, commentaries, lectures, and articles in the New York Times. Now, since these caves, of course, were discovered, Bedouin almost immediately began combing the hills throughout the Judean desert. Right now, as you well know, since territory is about to be given up, the Israeli government has sent out every archaeologist they could find and adopted many amateur archaeologists to go through all of the territories that they're about to give back to make sure that they find every possible scroll they can before they give these territories back. And that's what's going on right now in Eretz Yisrael in the light of these discoveries. Now, I just want to spend a few minutes describing the present controversy so you'll be aware why this has been in the newspapers in the last few years, and to bring you up to date as to where we are with regard to this. soon as the scrolls were discovered in 1947, they were discovered in Qumran, which at that time belonged to Jordan. And certainly after 1948, it was in the hands of Jordan. As the scrolls were discovered, they would be brought to the old city of Jerusalem, and they were kept in the Rockefeller Museum in the old city of Jerusalem. Of course, 1948, we lost Jerusalem to the Jordanians. The old city was taken over entirely by the Jordanians, even though by the UN rules it was supposed to be an international city, and it remained in the hands of the Jordanians until 1967 war. The Jordanians, of course, had no interest at all in allowing Jews any access to these scrolls, and the Jordanians, of course, couldn't read these scrolls either. They immediately appointed an international team of scholars, some 10 to 15 scholars, to whom they assigned all the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it became the responsibility of these scholars to read the scrolls and ultimately publish them. An agreement was reached between Oxford University Press, Oxford, England, and the Jordanian government that Oxford would be the official company that would publish all the Dead Sea Scrolls in perhaps 25 volumes. That's what was imagined at that time in 1947. The scandal of the Dead Sea Scrolls is the fact that now we are in 1994, so some 45 years have passed since the scrolls were discovered, and in 45 years, 9 volumes of Dead Sea Scrolls have been published. Those 9 volumes may add up to perhaps 2% of the material that's been discovered. In 45 years, 9 volumes of the projected 25, we now know it'll be a projected 100, not 25 at least. In any event, very little has really surfaced. And this has been described by many as the academic scandal of the 20th century. Now, let me tell you what you're not going to find in print, but what's really behind this slow publication process. What's behind it is very simple. You took scrolls written in Hebrew, all from the time of Second Temple times. We have Talmidei Chachamim all over the world, in yeshivas, and in schools and programs, rabbis, who, if you gave them these scrolls, would have absolutely no problem reading these scrolls, studying them, writing commentaries on them, and they could publish them in no time. But of course, the Jordanians would not allow a Jew access to the scrolls. They were assigned to 10 to 15 Christian scholars, all of them either Roman Catholics or Protestants, very able scholars. I'm not here to denigrate non-Jewish scholars, very able scholars. But scholars who couldn't read this material. It's written in Rabbinic Hebrew. It's written in Aramaic. It's from Gemara Lashon, very early. They hadn't the foggiest notion what these scrolls were or how to read them, and it took them 45 years to publish 9 volumes. The miracle is that they got 9 volumes out. Adarav, kol hakavod. But there's no way they were going to get more than 9 volumes out. Now, just to show you how far this goes, I knew one of the scholars is no longer alive to whom some of the scrolls were assigned. It was John Allegro, one of these Christian scholars and he described, and I heard him describe this, he described how, when they were in the scrollery in the Rockefeller Museum, how they discovered a particular scroll and identified it. And I'm going to tell you what he said. He said as follows, he'll never forget, he said, they were together, he with a group of assistants, they had this beautiful scroll, that was among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they opened it up, beautiful script, but they had no idea what it was. He said, I read the first word, I was able to see the first word in the first column, and I worked on it for a while, and it became clear to me that the first word was chazon. Chazon. I had no idea what it was, but sure it looked like a biblical book. So he said he pulled out a concordance. And he looked up in the concordance, where is there a book that begins with the word chazon? And he looked at the next word, and sure enough, it was Yeshayo. He realized that he had discovered an Isaiah scroll. Well, now you can see, if that's how you're going to read the Dead Sea Scrolls, why, it's a miracle that they got 9 volumes in 45 years. There was a scholar alive in those days, a kind of radical scholar. His name was Solomon Siflin. Some of you may have heard of him, who could have read these scrolls with ease. He was allowed no access to scrolls. And because he was allowed no access to the scrolls, he declared that the scrolls are fakes. He said they're medieval documents. They're not authentic scrolls. And I once heard him get up at a meeting when he was challenged by all the great Dead Sea Scroll scholars, and they told him, these are real documents. He said, when you assign me a scroll and let me work on one, that's when I'll admit that they're authentic. All right. Anyway, this was the scandal that's behind all the recent conversation. Now, one man, his name is Herschel Shanks. He is the editor of the magazine that's circulating here, Biblical Archaeology Review. He is a layman, a Jew, very ardent Jew, not a great Talmud Chacham, and not really an expert in Dead Sea Scrolls, but very interested in Biblical Archaeology and the scrolls, published beautiful photographs of them, as you see in this magazine that's circulating. He decided to make this his pet project. He was going to let the world know about this scandal, and especially, one, that the scrolls hadn't been published, and two, that no Jew had been assigned a Dead Sea Scroll. Now, he would not ever be assigned a Dead Sea Scroll, and he knew that, but this was his cause. Everybody has their cause in the world, and he took this on as his cause and his contribution to society. And for years and years, year after year, he published this magazine, and he published editorials and pamphlets. He campaigned, he went to public meetings, he put up posters. He tried everything he could to bring this to the attention of the academic world, to the public world. Nobody cared. Nobody listened. No one was interested. And it's very difficult to take on the academic establishment. He took on the academic establishment and basically bruised his nose. That's all he was able to do. He couldn't really accomplish anything. He never gave up. And what you learn from this man is the value of determination. This man was determined. He was also well connected, and he was well connected to the New York Times, and he began informing the New York Times about this thing. All of a sudden, little articles appeared in the New York Times, letters to the editor in the New York Times, and so on. And that also didn't work, but this man was determined. And he then did something that's probably immoral. I don't want to be the one to judge, but he, in effect, decided he would do what he had to do. Kind of the end justifies the means. So he informed the New York Times that apparently the reason these scrolls are not being published is because it would bring down the Catholic Church. The Pope in Rome discovered, or was informed by these 10 or 15 scholars, that there are certain Dead Sea Scrolls that contain material that would prove once and for all either that the founder of Christianity never lived, or basic teachings of Christianity are false, and therefore, this is a conspiracy of the Roman Catholic Church that has kept the scrolls from appearing in print. Well, when that appeared in the New York Times, all of a sudden it got everybody's attention. And it appeared not only in the New York Times, but every newspaper in the world. And church figures got involved, and rabbis got involved, and everybody began being interviewed. And in fact, Jews joined the bandwagon. That didn't satisfy Shanks. It wasn't enough just to blame the church. Shanks also let them know that a group of rabbis got together and are worried about the scrolls and what they may reveal. And rabbis also were in on this conspiracy, and Israelis were in on the conspiracy to make sure that these scrolls wouldn't get published. This happened in the last 4 years or so. Well, once these rumors began to spread, then it became very embarrassing. Tremendous pressures were brought to bear on the academic establishment, and the academic establishment began to crumple, and the Israeli government began having serious problems because, you all know, in 1967, Yerushalayim, the old city of Jerusalem, fell into the hands of the Israelis. And lo and behold, the Rockefeller Museum now belonged to the Israeli government. All the Dead Sea Scrolls now were in the hands of the Israelis. And the Israelis had to make a decision as to what they would do. And the Israeli government very quickly decided, and perhaps wisely and diplomatically, that they would honor the assignment of the Dead Sea Scrolls as was made by Jordan. It is, they weren't about to rock the boat. Remember, these 10, 15 people were the world's leading scholars, professors at Harvard, professors at the University of Paris and elsewhere, really very distinguished scholars, and they weren't about to fire these people, especially Israel, and it would cause a lot of ill will, as you could imagine. So Israel did nothing, and now pressures were being brought to bear on Israel. You have the scrolls. You can do something about it. The time has come to do something about it. Everything pretty much remained as it is with all the noise until until 1991, when something incredible happened. And this is all due, again, credit goes to Shanks. Shanks received a telephone call in 1991 from a librarian in California. And the librarian in California said, you know, I sympathize with you. You are absolutely right. This is the scandal of the century. We must get these scrolls published. I have a copy, a photographic copy of all the Dead Sea Scrolls. Would you like to see it? Shanks was shocked. This was incredible. And what Shanks discovered was that the Jordanians and the international team that had been assigned these scrolls were well aware that these scrolls were being kept in the Rockefeller Museum, the old city of Jerusalem, which is one of the most dangerous places in the world to keep a Dead Sea Scroll. War could break out at any time, bombs could fall, missiles could fall, all the scrolls would be destroyed. So very early on in the history of the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the late 40s, a decision was made to photograph all the Dead Sea Scrolls and all the fragments, everything. And copies were deposited in approximately 5 libraries throughout the world, complete copies. No one knowing about this, except the members of the international team and the 5 librarians, those 5 libraries, this is a secret, who are told that they could never reveal this and they could never show these scrolls to anyone unless Jerusalem should be destroyed and it would become necessary. Well, because Shanks had brought this to the attention of the whole world, one of these 5 librarians in California said, you could look at them. And not only can you look at them, I'll give them to you. You can do whatever you like with them. You can publish them. And Shanks took all those photographs. In 1991 and 1992, he published 2 massive volumes. I brought one with me. All the photographs, all the fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You need a high-powered magnifying glass to read this. But they're available. You can buy them in the local bookshop. These 2 massive volumes, all of the unpublished materials of the Dead Sea Scrolls, all those photographs from 1948. This is actually most of them, it's not all of them, but it's almost all of them. This Shanks published in 1991 and 1992, and once he published these 2 volumes, the walls came tumbling down. As soon as these 2 volumes were published, the Israeli government realized it was all over. Everybody now has a copy of the scrolls. What was the sense? What did it mean that the scrolls were assigned to a scholar? Anybody can buy these volumes, read the scroll, write your commentary, and publish before the scholar, because the scholars weren't publishing anyway. It took them so long. So then Israel said, look, Shanks is really right. We don't want to give him the rights to all these Dead Sea Scrolls anyway. He's selling his book, becoming wealthy. We will make the photographs available to anyone who wants them. First of all, Israel said, any scholar in the world who wants to come to Jerusalem can come and look at the original scrolls, any scroll, any fragment, if they want to. Second, the government said, we will now publish on microfiche, in color, all these photographs, new photographs, better photographs, and make these available. And they now are available. And anybody in New York, if you want, you can go to Yeshiva University, the 5th floor, and Yeshiva University have all the Dead Sea Scrolls on microfiche, and anybody can look at them in their microfiche machine, as does any major library today in the United States. So the scrolls have become available. Moreover, Israel decided finally to reassign the scrolls, not to these 10, 15 scholars, but they worked together with these 10 and 15, took away many of those scrolls, and reassigned them to a younger group and much larger group of scholars, and now for the first time to many Jews, professors at the Hebrew University, professors here in New York, in Baltimore. Some of you may know Professor Joseph Baumgarten, a very distinguished Rav in Baltimore, and a Dead Sea Scrolls scholar. He's been assigned some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are people who can read them. But the condition that was made with all these scholars who've now been assigned these scrolls is they must publish the scrolls before the year 2000. That is, they have 4 or 5 years maximum, or else the scroll gets taken away from them. So, and now they will be published very quickly with commentary done by very able scholars, because if not, any amateur can come along and publish whatever he likes. And as a matter of fact, that's exactly what's happened. The worst fears of the scholars, and the scholars were right about this, was the reason why only 9 volumes were published is because this is difficult material. First of all, it's a jigsaw puzzle. You have to put lots of fragments together, otherwise you can't read the text. First, you have to create the text. Very good. Average person can't do that. It takes years to do that. And what's happening now is amateurs who have these books, or who look at the microfiche, are publishing book after book, and many books have been published, and they were just full of nonsense about the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that, there'll be a lot of nonsense. On the other hand, there will also be very good scholarship, and hopefully all of us living in this era of modern technology where so much nonsense is published, we're going to have to be able to distinguish between what's really significant and what's not. And we're going to have to do it with the Dead Sea Scrolls, and unfortunately we have to do it with every field of study if we're living in this age. Okay, let's go to passage one. Sorry.
How did Kang Sabu, the case recently where there was sued?
Very briefly, the question is, the question is where the Shanks was sued by a professor in Israel and lost the case in Israel. Shanks made one mistake. There was no problem in publishing all these photographs. These were in libraries, and he got them legally from one of these libraries, and no one could fault him for doing that. It might have been immoral and so on, but it's not illegal. But he appended to the beginning of this first volume that I'm actually holding a transcription of a Dead Sea Scroll. It was not among the photographs. He couldn't get a photograph. So he printed a transcription in Hebrew letters of a scroll that's been assigned to one of the scholars that was not available to him in a photograph. This transcription was done by a scholar, a very able and a Shomer Shabbos scholar, by the way, by the name of Elisha Kimron. Kimron had transcribed the scroll and spent years of his life reading this very difficult text, putting together pieces of text. And this was going to be a book that Kimron was about to publish, his masterwork. It is a copy of Miktat Masei Torah, the scroll that I mentioned before, which still hasn't been published officially. Unofficially, it's available in the first page of this book. Shanks illegally got a hand copy that was taken from Kimron's house, okay, of Kimron's transcription of the scroll. He published it so that he would have all the Dead Sea Scrolls and certainly all the major unpublished Dead Sea Scrolls included in this facsimile edition. Kimron sued. And Kimron won the case in Israel. It came before a court in Israel, and Kimron won the case, and a very heavy fine was placed on Shanks. I have no idea whether Shanks will ever pay that fine. I assume that Shanks will appeal. In any event, it just has to do with international law. Shanks is here in America, published it here in America. This is a scroll that was written and done in Israel, and I guess you get into all sorts of legal questions, which I'm not competent to handle. But in any event, officially, Shanks lost the case, and he must pay, otherwise he cannot come to Israel, because should he come to Israel, he could be arrested on the spot. He knows that. So my best recollection reading the last issues of the magazine that he publishes is he intends to pay. He will appeal, but if he loses the appeal, he'll pay, because he'll have no magazine afterwards. So you can't write on biblical archaeology without spending a lot of time in Israel and having the cooperation of the Israeli scholars. So he got himself in a difficult situation. But that's the story. It was only this one document that he inserted here. On and on. They found letters of Bar Kokhba. They found the official letters written by the chief of the Israeli forces in the year 132, 133, and so on, with signed by Bar Kokhba, his name, sent to General so-and-so, and so forth, and so forth. We have the original copies of official military documents bearing messages from Bar Kokhba to various Jewish officials. And I want to read to you the text of one of the letters, which surprised modern scholars. Now, first of all, now we have a signature, so we know what he called himself, right? And he didn't call himself Ben Kozila, and he didn't call himself Bar Kokhba either. We know what his real name is now, because we have his autograph, right? So he called himself Shimon Ben Kosiba. He spelt his name Chav Samach Beis Aleph. Shimon Ben Kosiba. So Chav, his father's name presumably, was Chav Samach Beis Aleph. And he actually, we have some Greek transcriptions of one of these letters, and it's, in the Greek letters, it's K-O-S-I-B-A. So now listen to one of the letters. Immediately what I can tell you is it's very simple what happened. His name was Shimon Ben Kosiba. That was a fine name for whatever his father's name was. His supporters called him Bar Kokhba. His detractors, those who saw that he was a false messiah, called him Ben Kosiba. And both of them are plays of words on his name. Okay, in any event, listen to the letter. From Shimon ben Kosiba to Yehuda ben Galgula and to the people of Israel, Shalom. I have sent you two donkeys that you shall send with two men to Yehonasan Barbayon, in order that they shall pack and send to the camp towards you palm branches. I'm sending two convoys, two donkeys, with lulavim, palm branches, and esrogen, citrons. And you from your place send others who will bring myrtles, hadassin, the text reads, and willows, aravin. See that they are tithed, and send them to the camp. Signed, Shimon Bar Kokhba, commander-in-chief of the Israeli forces, while in bleeding battle, sends orders to various commanders to make sure that lulavim and esrogen, hadassin, and aravin are ready and available, made available to the soldiers. So there are no atheists in foxholes. Scholars couldn't believe this. This was not their image of Bar Kokhba. But here it is. We actually have the letter that he wrote. Amazing. So this too is interesting. And it turns out, in other words, that even before Chief Chaplain Rabbi Gorin, Jewish generals were worried about Shmiras Shabbos and Yontif in the Israeli army. Let's go to passage 3 on page 2, and that'll be the final passage we'll discuss. The hour is getting late. The background for this passage, if you need to know, and almost everybody in this room will know this very well, is that in the Torah, Parshas Emor, we have a description of a korban that was brought. It was called the Korban HaOmer, the Omer offering, which we today commemorate by what we call Sfiras HaOmer. And when do we start counting Sfira? Okay. Second night of Pesach, all right? Motzoi Yom Tov Rishon Shel Pesach, right? The second Seder night, second Seder night. I don't know what the minig is in Far Rockaway, I don't remember. Some people count Sfira in Shul before the Seder, and others count the Sfira at the end of the Seder. This is a famous halachic discussion which need not concern us here. But we all agree that we start counting Sfira the second night of Pesach, either before the Seder or at the Seder itself, as the case may be. Mitzvah Yom Tov Rishon Shel Pesach. Why? Because Korban Omer, the Torah tells us, is that you shall bring this, we mocher as HaShabbos, he nifenu hakom. The Torah tells us that this first offering of the Omer that was brought, the cutting of the grain, the reaping of the grain, this would take place, we mocher as HaShabbos, on the morrow, or the day after Shabbos. And the Gemara asks, what's Shabbos? And the Gemara says, Shabbos means the first day of Pesach, the first day of Pesach. It's the first day of Yontif. In the time of the Torah, of course, there was only one day, the first day of Yontif. You're not allowed to work, so it's the day of Shabbos. It's like Shabbos. And right after that first day of Yontif, Motzei Yom Tov Rishon, we cut the Omer, and from there we count 50 days, and then we celebrate again Shavuos on the Mimocharas HaShabbos, Kfartu Lechem Mimocharas HaShabbos, and so on. We count 50 days, 7 weeks, and so on. Now, when the first day of Pesach fell on a Friday, which it can, first day of Pesach fell on a Friday, then Mimachar HaShabbos would be what? Friday night.
Shabbos.
Now the question is, do you reap the Omer? Remember, they have to reap. Siroah, one of the Lamedes Malachos. If the first day of Pesach, the first day of Pesach was on a Friday, then the reaping ceremony would have to take place Friday night, or we call Shabbos. That's what this Mishnah is talking about. So now we take a look at the Mishnah, and the Mishnah says, what do you do when that happens? The Mishnah describes in vivid detail what you do when that happens. I'd like to go down the Mishnah 3, 6, 7 lines. Shabbos. What happens if it's Shabbos? What happens if the first day of Pesach is Friday? Now it's Friday night. Pesach is over the first day. The first night, Motzei Pesach, but it's Shabbos. Shabbos Chol HaMoed. The Shabbos, what do you do? Omer Lahem, Shabbozo. The person who's about to reap turns to Bezdin and he says, on this Shabbos, you want me to cut the wheat over in Egypt, the Oraisa? Omrim Hain, yes. Shabazo, Omrim Hain. They say, yes. Exor, I should reap. The Hain Omrim Loksor. He asks again, Exor, I should reap. The Hain Omrim Loksor. Shlosha, Pa'onim, Al-Kol Davidov. Every act is repeated three times. It's very ceremonious. He asks, should I do this, and so on, even though it's Shabbos, and they say yes. The Beis Din says, do it. V'heim om yilo, hang, hang, hang. Each time they answer, hang. Kol kach lama. What is this charade? What is this whole ceremony that we're going through? We have to repeat every act three times. Mishnah says, Mishneha Baitusim. Because of the Baitusim, group that we don't know too much about, but obviously a group of Jewish heretics, a Jewish sect that the rabbis disagree with, and they did this to teach a lesson to the Baitusim, that we do it this way, even though you do it some other way. How you, Omrim? And what is it that the Baitusim used to say? Ein Ktsiras HaOmer b'Motzei Yom. They say there's no Ktsiras HaOmer after the first day of Yom Tov, meaning the first day of Pesach. That's not when you do Ktsiras HaOmer. When did they do Ktsiras HaOmer? So everybody knows, we all know, that the Tzedukim and the Baitusim, they said, in the Torah it says, Mimocharas HaShabbos, that you have to bring the Omer offering on the morrow after the Sabbath. They said Shabbos means Shabbos, Saturday. And therefore, Mimacharas HaShabbos means what? Sunday, at least it was either Saturday night or Sunday morning. And indeed, we know that Tzedukim by Kusim always celebrated the Omer offering on a Sunday, and therefore, if you count Shavuot, exactly 7 weeks later, for them, Shavuot always has to fall out on a Sunday. And the Gemara knows this very well in the Sugya and Maseches Menachos. I always had a problem with this Mishnah whenever I learned this, with the language. Last line says, Ein Tzira Sa'omer B'Motzei Yom Tov. There's no reaping after the first day of Yom Tov, for the first day of Pesach is over. And I was always troubled by this, because supposing the first day of Pesach is Shabbos, which it certainly can be. The first day of Pesach is Shabbos. Imagine the situation, the first day of Pesach is Shabbos. What will happen Motzei Shabbos? You'll bring the Omer, right? And now it's going to be Mimacharas HaShabbos for them as well. They'll be very happy when the first day is Pesach, if Pesach is Shabbos, they'll be delighted to bring the Korban Omer Motzei Yom Tov. See, this language, Shehoyu Omrim Ein Tziras Omer Motzei Yom Tov, is very strange. What I would have expected here is Ein Tziras HaOmer Ella B'Yom Rishon, or Ella Mimacharas HaShabbos. But I wouldn't connect it to Motzei Yom Tov. What do I care about Motzei Yom Tov? That's not what's at stake here. And when I looked through the Mefarshei Mishnayos, when I first learned this and was troubled by it, I have a principle in learning. And the principle is, if you ask a question in learning, it's a good question, it's inconceivable that it hasn't been asked already. All the great Gedolim who learned for so many centuries, the Bali Atos will learn more Gemara than I will ever learn, Rabbi Akiva Egel will learn more Gemara than I will ever learn, and if I have a question, it's inconceivable that all these Gedolim missed an obvious question. Somebody would have written about it. So sure enough, almost always I've been lucky and I find it. In this particular case, it took me a long time, but I found it. There's a parish on Mishnayos called Kol Sofer by a great Hungarian Rav. His name was Chaim Sofer, the chief rabbi of Budapest, the author of Shas and Shulis Machane Chaim, for those of you familiar with it. And his parish on Mishnayos, in the Nachos, he asked the question. And he says, Bar Onochi. I have the text in front of me, anybody's welcome to come by. He says, I don't understand. Bar Onochi. Mehoven Lashon Hagmar. I don't understand this Lashon. Shabbaitusim Omrim Ein Ktsiras HaOmer B'Motzei Yom Tov V'lo Kasav, and the Mishnah didn't say Shehoyu Omrim Ktsiras HaOmer B'Motzei Shabbos Bereishis. What it should have said is, what they say is, Mimacharas HaShabbos, Shabbos doesn't mean Pesach, Shabbos means Saturday. And Mimacharas HaShabbos means Saturday night or Sunday. He asked the question. He can't answer. He goes on, he gives an answer, but no one in this room will be persuaded by the answer that he is, but again, he didn't have access to the material that we have access to. So now, if you turn to the page 3. Now this is very interesting, and briefly, it brings home a point that I need to make. This is at the end of Sefer, one of the copies of Sefer Tehillim. found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. It tells us that at the end is a little paragraph and says, David HaMelech wrote Sefer Tehillim. And as you can see, by Yehi David Ben Yishai Chacham, those of you who need the English, it's right at the bottom of the page, you can follow the English. So David Ben Yishai was wise. I'm going to skip to the third line, by Yichtov Tehillim, he authored Tehillim. Shloshes Alofim V'Sheish Me'os. Shloshes Alofim V'Sheish Me'os. Okay, period. He wrote 3,600 Tehillim. That's much more, obviously, than we have in our Tehillim. V'shir l'shore l'fnei ha-mizbeach. He also wrote songs to be recited at the Mizbeach. Alol ha-satamid, for the Karban Talmud. L'chol yom v'yom. Every day we bring Talmud. Okay, Alol ha-satamid. L'chol yom v'yom. L'chol yom v'yashana. How many? Arbo v'shishim v'shlosh me'ot. 364 songs he wrote for every day that you bring the regular Korban Olah. How many days are there in a Jewish calendar? Our calendar, here's the rule. No? The rule is simple. Jewish calendar always has 6 months of 30 days and 6 months of 29 days. I'll give the exception in a minute, but as a general rule, the Jewish calendar always has 6 months of 29 days, 6 months of 30 days. No Jewish month could ever have either less than 29 days or more than 30. In the old days when we had witnesses who came, if witnesses came on day 30 and said they saw a new moon, so then the previous month was 29 days, and day 30 became day 1 of the next month. If no witnesses came on day 30, then the previous month automatically had 30 days, and day 31 was automatically day 1 of the next month. You can only have either 29 or 30 days in a Jewish month. And the way the calendar is fixed, since we have what's called a lunar calendar in effect, the lunar month is somewhere between 29 and 30 days, so we have 6 of 29 and 6 of 30. Well, if you multiply 6 times 29 plus 6 times 30, so how many days do we have? 354. Now, you all know that if we would always have 354 days, after a while we would be, we'd have great problems with the solar calendar, because the solar year is somewhere around 365 days. And so they want to rectify the discrepancy between the seasons of the solar year, which is 365 days, and our calendar, which is 354 days. So 6 times in every 19 years we have a leap year. We add an extra Chodesh, the Chodesh Adar, and we have we make up for the so the seasons will coincide with our calendar. Okay. But here it says that David HaMelech, according to this Jewish group, the Dead Sea sect, he wrote a shir for every day of the year. And how many days are there in the year? 364. Dead Sea sect had a different calendar. This is not our calendar. They had a solar calendar. A solar calendar. Now, simple mathematical calculation that you'll help me with. We have 354 days. 354 divisible by 7? Mathematicians? No, it's not. It's not. That's why in the Jewish calendar every year the Yom Tovim fall out on different days. If it would be divisible by 7, then every year every Yom Tov would fall out on the same day of the week. Since it's not, because there's a remainder every year, so every year a calendar starts at a different place, and Yom Tovim fall in different places in the calendar. But if you have a 364-day calendar, as the Dead Sea sect had, is that divisible by 7?
Yeah.
It is. It certainly is. And therefore, in the Dead Sea sect, every yontif, every year, always fell on the same day. Pesach always fell, first day of Pesach was always on a Wednesday. First day of Rosh Hashanah was always on a Wednesday. Yom Kippur was always, I believe, on a Friday. And so on, you can figure it out. Anyway, their calendar was static in that sense, that since 364 is divisible by 7, there were the exact number of weeks in every year, the calendar kept recycling, and every yontif would always fall on the same day. But we have the calendar of the Dead Sea sect now, and we know exactly what it looks like, and we know that Pesach, now by the Torah, Pesach has to fall on the month of Nisan. First day is always what day in Nisan? 15th day of Nisan. The Dead Sea sect can't disagree. They have the Torah. So for them also, Pesach begins the 15th day of Nisan. But the first day of Pesach, the 15th day of Nisan, is always a Wednesday. And then they celebrated 7 days Pesach. There is no Yom Tov Rabbanan at this point. So they celebrate 7 days Pesach, because Pesach in the Torah is 7 days. And Pesach ends on a Tuesday, on a Tuesday, week, next week on a Tuesday, which is going to be the 21st of Nisan. And then there's the Shabbos after Pesach. The Shabbos after Pesach is the Shabbos of Mimachos HaShabbos for the Dead Sea Sect, and they start bringing, and they bring the Omer offering, Mimachos HaShabbos, on the Saturday night after the Shabbos. That's immediately after Pesach. Pesach begins on a Wednesday. It ends on the 21st, Nisan on a Tuesday. And they bring the carbon on Motzei Shabbos, which is the 26th day of Nisan. Then they count it 50 days. They always celebrated Shavuos on the 15th day of Sivan, the third month. Okay, we have the calendar, we know this now. So what does it come out to the Dead Sea Sect? This language is superb. Go back to the last line of the Mishnah, where the Baitusim, who are, I can assure you, related to the Dead Sea Sect, and maybe, in fact, is the name of the Dead Sea Sect. And what did the Baitusim say? In the Gemara's language, it's precise. Ein Tzirus Omer Motzei Yontov. Tzirus Omer is never Motzei Yontov. It's never after the first day of Pesach. We say it's never on Wednesday, Tuesday night or Wednesday night. Tzirus Omer is always on a Saturday night, Sunday, after Shabbos, after the whole Yontov of Pesach is over. It has nothing to do with the first days of Pesach at all. The language is perfect. We now know this is exactly what the sect taught. Chazal understood this. We have the evidence now so we can see why Chazal cited them precisely. But before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we really couldn't know this. Now, I want to go back to that Gemara in Pesachim just briefly because I don't want to leave you hanging. And I raised that issue. Why could there even be a discussion in the Gemara that they didn't remember, that they didn't remember at all what the Kabbalah was? Nobody in Eretz Yisrael remembered until Hillel came, Ari Olam Yibavel, and could say it in the name of Nei Bisera. Well, you take a look. Okay. Take a look. What we now know, and this relates to the question of the temple scroll, that's why I said I'd get back to it when I discussed this. You asked about, is it the third temple or not? I'm not sure it's the third. I don't think it's the third temple at all. It's the second temple and the first temple that's described in the temple scroll. It's not a third temple. It's the Beis HaMikdash as they envisioned it. And now what you have to know is that Chazal had a view of the Beis HaMikdash, and they built the Beis HaMikdash, and they followed their halachas, as we have it in the Torah, and as we have it in rabbinic literature, and so on, and Chazal had their calendar. I just, you have to understand the seriousness of what was going on in Second Temple times. When we celebrated Yom Kippur, it wasn't Yom Kippur for the day, they ate. When they celebrated Yom Kippur, when the Dead Sea Sect celebrated Yom Kippur, we ate. And if the Kohen Gadol goes in to the Kodesh Kadoshim on the wrong day, when it's not Yom Kippur, he's Chayav Nisa. Now you see there was a struggle for control of the temple. And what the temple scroll describes are the festival days and all the practices of the Dead Sea Sect. When they controlled the temple, they did things their way. When they controlled the temple, Yom Kippur was according to their calendar, not according to our calendar. We at home, we followed our calendar. You can be sure Chazal never gave up their calendar. But we weren't always in control of the Beis HaMikdash. And now we know for sure that the Tzedukim controlled the Beis HaMikdash, sometimes for many, many years. If they were in control of the Beis HaMikdash, they brought the Karbonos according to their calendar. They celebrated Mimachos HaShabbos on Sunday or Saturday night, and they celebrated Shavuos on Sunday and Saturday night. Now, if you realize that the Sadducees, or the Baitusim, or the Essenes, whoever this group may be, or all these groups, had calendars that differed from the rabbis, and we know this from rabbinic literature, we don't have to depend on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but now we have a clearer picture of the calendar, what it looked like, then there were periods of time, and we know this from Josephus, where Chazal didn't control Bayis Sheni. There might have been a period of 50 or 60 years where we couldn't bring a Korban Pesach. And now you can understand why it's possible for a dor to suddenly wonder, what happens? What happens when Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos? Are we allowed to carry and allowed to do all the things we have to do to bring the Korban Pesach? And if you had 50 consecutive years where the Sadducees were in control of the temple, and there was such periods, then there were 50 years where the Korban Pesach wasn't brought to Halach. And you might well forget what the halacha was, as discussed in Sefer Pesach. It seems to me that's the simplest solution to this issue. Okay, let me simply conclude. I wish I had the evidence. It wouldn't surprise me, but I don't have the evidence.
The Gemara certainly says it, but the Dead Sea Fact doesn't say it. All right. I'll be happy, anyone who wants to stay after I'm done, and I'll be happy to sit and talk to you and discuss whatever questions you want to raise. But I also have rahmanas on those people who are tired. What I really want to say is that the Dead Sea Scrolls are without question a momentous discovery. And remember, I'm only talking about a very small percentage of the material that's been published. There's much more to come. Who knows what we'll see in the texts that have been published to date. In any event, what's been published to date already sheds much light on the text of Tanakh, on the Hebrew and Aramaic languages, on the vocabulary of the period, on the history of Judaism, and specifically on the history of Halacha, now the history of rabbinic texts. We can understand passages and see them in a light and in a way that we couldn't see them in the past. I want to close with one of my favorite passages from one of the great Musa Sfarim. This is Mechobos HaLevavos. Mechobos HaLevavos was written by Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Fakuda. He was a great Spaniard, a Faradi, who lived in Andalus in the 11th century. And in his Mechobos HaLevavos, Shar Cheshbon HaNefesh is a beautiful passage which, to me, as relevant as ever, and especially in light of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Here's what he says. A man must make a reckoning with his soul and judge it as to every matter that is established in it pertaining to knowledge of God and of the Torah, and knowledge of the traditions of the ancients, knowledge of the history of the forefathers, and the meanings of the prayers and the hymns, the tefillos. These are things we all learned in our youth. These are things we learned when we first began to grow and we were first initiated in our studies. For the form of subtle things in the eyes of a man of weak understanding is different from their form in the eyes of an intelligent man. The stronger one's understanding, the stronger his certainty of things. Therefore, you must not be content with matters nor with the explanations that were impressed on your mind at the beginning of your studies. But rather you should reconsider the Torah and the prophets, now that your mind is stronger and your understanding sharper, as if you had never read a letter of them. You must deal the same way with the philos, with the prayers and hymns. Try to understand their language and their purpose, so that when you approach the Lord with them, you will understand the words your tongue is uttering and the meaning your heart is conveying. You must not follow the habit of your youth, when you said whatever your tongue could pronounce. You have to deal the same way in the history of our traditions. You need to try to understand them thoroughly and think of them deeply. You must not be satisfied with what you achieved when you first began your studies. Rather, demand of yourself that you reconsider as if you are a novice. Reconsider all that you learned until you discover new meanings in the Torah, new meanings in the books of the prophets and the sages, such things as you could never have understood from the teachers who taught you when you first began your studies. So the Chobos HaLevavos, thank you very much. Any questions?